Case number 20-1344, BorgWarner Thermal Systems, Inc. versus Carlisle Brake and Friction, Inc. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Drosky, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Tim Drosky, appearing on behalf of Carlisle Brake and Friction, and I'll be reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very good.
Summary judgment in this case must be reversed because the district court erred in holding that Carlisle, more than 5 months after the party's three-year fixed-term contract had already expired, was nonetheless still held hostage to the pricing terms in that now-expired contract and forced to continue to supply BorgWarner with parts at the same price and at a substantial loss. That effectively and inappropriately converted what BorgWarner now for the first time concedes was a three-year fixed-term contract into a contract of indefinite duration, and which here was improperly enforced against Carlisle for an entire year beyond the party's agreed-to expiration date.
All right, Mr. Drosky, didn't your client voluntarily continue the pricing in the same terms from the end of April until July 30th when they requested a meeting to talk about the matter? So, I mean, we've got a few months after the expiration of the three-year contract where your client continued the practice here. Did not your client do that?
You're correct, Your Honor, that releases continued to be issued by BorgWarner after April 30th, 2008, and that Carlisle continued to ship goods at the same price. But the Inverson case that was cited in the brief reflects that there's nothing based on merely continuing, you know, for a few months afterwards that does anything to effectively renew a three-year term on the contract. And the district court expressly found, and again, BorgWarner doesn't contest here, that the contract expired on April 30th, 2018. And so if you were to look at the party's post expiration date conduct, which here the district court didn't get into at all. So if anything, this should be, you know, remanded for further consideration. You'd have kind of the same sort of battle of the forms situation. A release is issued, acceptance occurs based on the shipment under that release. You have conflicting terms and conditions, you know, BorgWarner trying to reference its terms and conditions, Carlisle in its invoices, including its own. And so those would conflict out, and at best, the court would have to impose a reasonable price term, or to the extent that those are daily contracts, there's nothing foreclosing Carlisle from saying that in October 2018, we need to be charging a higher price because we are providing you these goods at a loss. And BorgWarner's reservation of rights was just arguing that, again, the original purchase order still had some sort of binding effect. The district court again found that it was a three-year contract that expired on April 30th, 2018. There was nothing foreclosing Carlisle from charging a greater price to avoid continuing to operate at a loss in October of 2018. And so I'd like to first turn here to the battle of the forms issue. Because as the district court recognized, the central issue in this case is whether BorgWarner's terms and conditions apply to the purchase order. And on that issue, the district court fundamentally erred in its application of the battle of the forms under Michigan's UCC. The district court erred by entirely glossing over the Michigan UCC's clear distinction as to how it treats the proposal of additional terms as opposed to different terms. And this is
raised below by you. Additional as opposed to different terms, or is that raised first time on appeal?
No, it was squarely raised below. The battle of the forms was the primary issue raised below by Carlisle.
How about the distinction between different terms and additional terms? Did you raise that argument below?
It was, because the argument was clearly and squarely framed in terms of invoking the knockout rule. And okay, the knockout rule.
I don't think you did. I don't think you expressly raised that. That's all. And if you did, as opposed to in general, I guess I'd like to know where specifically you raised it.
Well, again, it would be with the invocation of the knockout rule. A knockout rule doesn't apply with respect to the phrasing of additional terms, right? Because in that case, the only question is whether the original terms in the offer apply, or whether an additional term is added to the party's agreement. A knockout term means that the two parties' conflicting terms knock each other out. And I would also say that Carlisle below expressly invoked Michigan UCC section 2207 subpart 3, which is the provision that says when terms are knocked out, then you look at the then UCC gap filling provisions fill in the blank. And so the battle of the forms was squarely raised. And the bottom line is that the district court fundamentally erred in applying binding Michigan UCC law and failing to recognize that distinction between additional and different terms. Right, that's a fundamental issue of error of law.
But did you make any specific argument to the district court that these were about the distinction between additional and different? In other words, if you're saying the district court erred for not recognizing this distinction, can we really fault the district court if you didn't explain the distinction to the court and how it applied in this case?
Well, Carlisle never argued that this was in any way an additional term. Its argument was always that these were terms that were squarely in conflict. And you see that just because on its very face. I mean, if the only predicate for Borg Warner being able to hold Carlisle hostage to these same prices after the contract has already expired, the only basis for that is paragraph 12. And no sort of post-contractual obligations upon Carlisle exist in any way in its terms and conditions. And it was clearly emphasized that each party's terms and conditions had provisions that said that they exclusively control. And so they're inherently conflicting and inherently different in that nature.
Mr. Drosky, it seemed to me as I read the briefing and the district court opinion that Board BW had made it clear from the outset that it would not proceed except under its terms and conditions. And what at least the district court read it, and I didn't see any challenge in your briefing, that to the fact that Carlisle then proceeded and by its performing, knowing that that was a, you know, drop dead condition, that it performed under, it gave up and performed under the conditions that were set by the non-negotiable stance taken by Board Warner, that ours shall apply. And your client went, okay, sorry, we'll go ahead because we want to sell these.
And that's not an entirely accurate reflection of the
record. So I need you to say what's wrong.
Right. And what's wrong with it is that Michigan UCC 440-2207 subpart 1 says that there can be an expression of acceptance from the seller back to the buyer, and that could be a written confirmation after the fact. Certainly, Borg Warner made its position clear that its terms and conditions would apply. But what's nowhere in the record.
And then Carlisle proceeded by performing.
But there's nothing in the record indicating anything short of shipment followed by the invoices with its own terms and conditions as the expression of that acceptance. There's no indication that Mr. Vamparella, sent an email or got on the phone.
I guess my question is, doesn't the performance suffice?
It doesn't because... It doesn't because the UCC 2207 subpart 1 says that even when the parties have agreed, there can be a later written confirmation that includes different terms. And you look at the case law and it's frequently recognized that an invoice that includes different terms, such as the terms and conditions included here, constitutes to get your foot in the door for the battle of the forms. We cited the Waukesha Foundry case in our brief, Advanced Concrete, Mid-South Packers. And in fact, even the primary case that the district court relied on, its own DACO decision, makes this clear. There you similarly had a provision in the purchase order saying that shipment is going to constitute acceptance. And what happened there is invoices subsequently sent with different or additional terms. And the court recognized that, look, the fact that you already shipped these goods forecloses any sort of argument that these invoices and your subsequent terms constitute some sort of counteroffer. But they are still credited as that written acceptance for purposes of 2207 subpart 1 and triggering the battle of the forms. Where DACO went wrong, but again, the same district court, is by failing to recognize the distinction that challenge machinery makes clear that different terms are supposed to be treated differently than additional terms. For the reasons stated here and in the briefs, summary judgment should be reversed based on the battle of the forms. But even alternatively, there are two other bases for reversal here. One is that even if paragraph 12 is considered to be part of the party's agreement, it does not apply in this kind of circumstance. Again, it's undisputed now that the purchase order expired on April 30th, 2018. Any obligation on Borg, paragraph 12 simply obligates what would obligate a seller to continue to provide goods according to the terms of the purchase order. That purchase order had expired. Those pricing terms were no longer in force. And if you think about paragraph 12 in BorgWarner's terms and conditions and what it mistakenly assumed this contract was, it's designed to apply in a life of program type agreement where Carlisle would be supplying goods for the entire life of BorgWarner's program. And in that kind of circumstance, the transition of supply provision makes sense because otherwise BorgWarner could be caught flat-footed if the contract expired or was canceled before it finished. But that same sort of reasoning doesn't apply when there's a fixed expiration date. Again, Michigan UCC section 2309 subpart 3 specifically says there's no requirement for reasonable notification when there's a fixed agreed upon end date. And that's because then the parties can appropriately plan. And particularly when paragraph 12 includes within it a provision that only a reasonable transition of supply period is allowed, there's no reason that Carlisle should be left holding the bag for an $850,000 loss based on BorgWarner's unreasonable misunderstanding that this was a life of term program, when instead it now recognizes that it was a fixed term agreement.
But doesn't the fact that it has the provision that after the expiration of the 3-year term, that the prices continue until an alternative supplier can be obtained? I mean that shows you that there is a continuation of the terms, does it not?
There's nothing in there that says that on the day after expiration, the same prices apply. Instead, it says that if in connection with the expiration, BorgWarner needs a reasonable period, that then that would continue. But here, the
council, if it needs a reasonable period, if it says they get a reasonable period up to a year and a half, right? And it only took 9 months here.
It says nothing about a year and a half. It's a reasonable period of time to transition. But because there was a fixed expiration date, BorgWarner reasonably should have been preparing for this eventuality before expiration. They did nothing to initiate any sort of discussion with Carlisle. And therefore, the contract expired on April 30th, 2018. If BorgWarner had taken some sort of reasonable actions beforehand, initiated conversations, that would be a different case. But there's nothing in paragraph 12 here that would allow them to, 6 months after the fact, complain.
But again, well, counsel, isn't that argument forfeited? I mean, at argument, I think the district court asked, do you believe that BorgWarner did not effectuate the transition within a reasonable time? And I think counsel said something like, well, I haven't litigated that question. I don't really have a position on it. So,
A few answers in response, Your Honor. I mean, first of all, again, the issue was not litigated. But this is the unique situation where, again, it's plaintiff who is being granted summary judgment. And so there should be and what I would also say is there should be an opportunity for litigation here because the lawsuit is being positioned differently here on appeal. For the first time, BorgWarner is conceding that this was a fixed term contract that expired on April 30th, 2018. So even if we were to concede, for example, that a 9-month transition of supply period was a reasonable amount of time, because the contract expired at the end of April 2018, BorgWarner should have been preparing for that 9-month transition period in advance of that expiration date. The 9-month clock shouldn't have just been able to tick. It started ticking 3 months after the fact, after the July 30th meeting. And so that still remains to be litigated and is directly a product of the concession here.
But the problem is, I mean, the plaintiff, BorgWarner, brought a motion for summary judgment based upon its allegations and the pleadings and whatever documentary evidence they've submitted. And once a motion for summary judgment is before the court, the party opposing it has to come forth with evidence to the contrary. You just can't say, okay, yes, you've alleged that this is a reasonable period, but I have no position on the plaintiff's claim. That doesn't create a genuine issue of material fact by saying that I have no position. And that's exactly what counsel said below. The court said, will you accept plaintiff's position? Would you agree that the transitional supply period was a reasonable period for the buyer to complete the transition to an alternative supplier? And the answer was, I have no position respectfully on that issue. So how is there an issue of fact, material fact, to go to the jury? How have you complied with your burden to rebut the motion for summary disposition on the issue?
Well, again, I would just repeat, Judge Griffin, that even if Carlisle did not dispute or did not litigate.
No, you didn't. I'm reading the concession in the record.
Right. But I would say that there's a fundamental difference now that it's conceded that the contract expired on April 30th. Even if 9 months is reasonable, there's still a question for when that should have started. And what I would say is, again, that there are other issues here that were preserved. The battle of the forms and the knockout rule was the primary argument that Carlisle raised. And on that issue, the district court erred in applying Michigan UCC law, both 2207 subpart 1, in not allowing the battle of the forms to be triggered, and then in failing to apply the binding law from Challenge Machinery. And for that reason alone, as well as the others raised in the brief, this court should reverse summary judgment, and at a minimum, there should be remand for Carlisle. Alternatively, judgment should be entered for Carlisle for the $265,000 outstanding.
Okay. Any further questions at this time, Judge Cook, Judge Larson? All right. Let's hear from the appellee counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. Brian Wassum on behalf of appellee BorgWarner. Your Honor, after reading the appellate briefs and listening to Mr. Drosky's argument, the court would be forgiven for thinking that there's any evidence in the record that Carlisle actually sent its terms and conditions back to BorgWarner in order to even spurk this battle of the forms discussion. There is not. That is the first of at least four hurdles that Carlisle has to overcome. If they don't overcome each of these hurdles, they lose this appeal. The first and most obvious is the evidentiary question. Where's the evidence that Carlisle exchanged its terms and conditions in response to the purchase order? The only piece of evidence relied on is this Rocco declaration, which is based entirely on information and belief, Your Honor. The other witnesses testify that they looked desperately for some kind of documentary evidence, knowing that they would lose the case otherwise. They couldn't find it. Ted Messmer, the CEO of the company, admitted that it's possible they didn't even send it because this was a long-term relationship and they didn't need to send the document again. So unless the court finds that the Rocco Declaration, based solely on information and belief, is enough evidence to hold that there's a material question of fact as to whether Carlisle returned its terms and conditions promptly upon following its first shipment of goods under this purchase order, Carlisle loses. The second hurdle is, Your Honor, unless you also find that Carlisle is permitted to accept the purchase order offer, not once when Vinod Vemparalis stopped pushing back and agreed to sign the purchase order as written, which are Carlisle's words, or not twice when Mr. Albright agreed to it and Carlisle admits that at that point it became the contract. Not three times when Carlisle responded by shipping goods, which again, Carlisle makes a judicial admission that was an act of acceptance, of terms and conditions, by the way, that say on their face, when you ship, you accept these terms and conditions exclusively. But they would have to, you would have to find that they could accept four times. Now with submitting this alleged set of terms and conditions in response to the purchase order after they've already shipped. Unless Carlisle can accept four times, then their terms and conditions have no part in this conversation, no part in the formation of the contract between the parties. On top of that, you also have to find that Carlisle's silence in the terms and conditions, even if their terms and conditions are cognizable in any stretch of the imagination. Their terms and conditions are silent on the issue of supporting a transition to a new supplier. They admit this repeatedly in their appellate arguments. Mr. Drosky's admitted it today. He says Carlisle's terms and conditions say nothing about supporting this transition. Then even under his approach to the UCC, that becomes an additional term, not a conflicting term, because our case law has shown you the challenge case, including that a current term is not knocked out under sub three unless it is expressly disagreeing between the two parties. In that case, it's an additional term. And where I should rephrase that, it's a term to which they don't propose a conflicting term, and thus it stays part of the contract. It is not knocked out under sub three, and it requires Carlisle to continue performing. Fourth, Your Honor, even if you get all the way to the end of the expiration of the 3 years, I want to caution the court that Mr. Drosky is desperately overstating the extent of our admission here about the three-year term. We admit that the contract has a three-year term on its face. What we did was we let go of the alternative argument that we made below in front of the district court, which the district court did not accept, that the life of the program language should be read into the face of the contract. That does not mean that the terms of the contract can't be extended. And by continuing to accept purchase orders and releases under the purchase order, which cite by number this same purchase order, which cite the same price terms, the same shipping terms, everything, all the same terms under the same purchase order, and Carlisle continuing to accept and perform those for three additional months, they're bound by the terms of that acceptance as well, which effectively extend the terms of the protective or the purchase order rather, for at least the term of the shipments listed in those releases, which incidentally go far beyond the period of time that that Barb Warner needed to transition to a new supplier. Only by clearing all of these hurdles can Carlisle possibly overcome its burden under Section 12 of our terms and conditions to support the transition, which is a key term, as we've explained, and as this court knows, being the Court of Appeal from the state of Michigan, the just-in-time auto supply system is a crucial one. Any disruption in the just-in-time supply of parts throws the entire automotive supply ecosystem out of whack, millions of dollars, plant shutdowns. This is not something that auto companies fool around with. There's a reason that Section 12 is in there. There's a reason that it applies to a term contract, a lifetime of the program contract, any type of contract, any type of termination of the relationship. Those parts need to continue coming, and we need to know that they're going to continue coming until we get another supplier up and running. In fact, Mr. Drosky's creative argument on appeal, I'll concede is its creativity, that the lifetime of the project is somehow more of a circumstance in which this is required. It's actually less. If we knew for certain that they were going to continue for the lifetime of the project, we wouldn't have as much, at least, of a concern that they were going to stop continuing to supply the product. But in fact, here, even in a term situation, we know that they're going to continue to supply for less than the term, so that we need to be able to support the transition. Either way, the Section 12 is written in order to anticipate any of these types of situations. Your Honors, the cases that Mr. Drosky relies on, Waukesha, Advanced Concrete, Mid-South Packers, they're all under their own facts. And as we've explained in our brief, Your Honor, none of them establish some sort of per se rule that you get to accept an offer more than once. The 22071 is written in the disjunctive, for one thing. It says shipment or a written expression of acknowledgement can serve as an offer. And Your Honor, it only speaks to the process of offer and acceptance. By definition, once a contract is formed, the process of offer and acceptance has been completed, and there is no more back and forth. That is the contract. And Carlisle judicially admitted several times that the contract was formed, came into effect several times before they even allegedly sent their terms and conditions back. These admissions, Your Honor, below were not accidental. Carlisle's trial counsel had a different theory of the case than their appellate counsel has put together. Down below, you will not find a battle of the forum argument in Carlisle's motion for summary judgment. Mr. Drusky just told you it was the central argument. It actually doesn't even appear. The Carlisle's motion for summary judgment focused on an argument that it was of the three-year term expiration, that it was not the purchase order wasn't a requirement, and it focused talked more about its post-expiration conduct. Carlisle didn't even make the battle of the forms argument until its response to our motion for summary judgment, and then only in passing and in the alternative, and not even talking about hardly any conversation at all about Section 12. I also want to point the court's attention to the cases cited in footnote 11 of our brief, which support the discussion of the distinction between the cases that are cited in the case. And particularly, there's a great quote in the Gulf States Utilities case. And this is a quote from another Ninth Circuit case. And it says here, under those facts, if the seller truly does not want to be bound unless the buyer assents to its terms, it can protect itself by not shipping until it obtains that assent, end quote. That speaks directly to the situation that we have here, Your Honors. Unless the court has any further questions, Your Honor, I'd encourage the court to affirm the decision below.
All right. Any questions, Judge Cook, Judge Larson? Okay. All right, Mr. Drosky, you've got 3 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. To respond to a few points, there's enough record evidence here for there to, at a minimum, be a fact issue in terms of whether the invoices were sent. Mr. Rocco's affidavit was not just based on mere information belief. Instead, paragraph 5 specifically says that based on his experience as a controller with Carlisle, as well as my actual knowledge, Carlisle, as a matter of practice, would, in response to releases for friction liners, issue invoices contemporaneously. And those invoices included CBF's terms and conditions. And that's at page ID 1626 of the appellate record. Also, it's not just solely Mr. Rocco's testimony. Mr. Pelleschi, in his deposition, this is at page ID 1330, confirmed that as soon as the product ships, the invoices are generated. And while Mr. Wassum has said that the different cases with respect to invoices being credited after shipment are all distinguishable on their facts, the key fact across the board is that under Section 207.1 of the UCC, you have sister circuits, you have other federal Michigan district courts crediting that an invoice, including different terms and conditions sent after shipment, gets your foot in the door for the battle of the forms. And with respect to the battle of the forms squarely being raised here, even if Carlisle did not raise that issue until its response to BorgWarner's motion for summary judgment, that would still, at a minimum, foreclose summary judgment being granted for plaintiff here. And fact issues could then continue to be litigated. And I would also just say with respect, and one of those remaining issues that would remain to be litigated is how the court should treat that post-contractual period after April 30th, 2018. While the parties had different briefing on that issue below, the district court's ruling for an exclusive reliance on paragraph 12 foreclosed the court from ever needing to reach those issues. So however that post-contractual period is to be characterized based on the party's course of dealings, et cetera, that's something that hasn't been litigated and should be litigated below. Again, these are cross motions for summary judgment, and there are sufficient fact issues here. The issues were raised as to the battle of the forms and outstanding issues that have been raised here regarding what happens post-contract are all issues that foreclose plaintiff from prevailing here on a motion for summary judgment, when again, all inferences need to be read in Carlisle's favor at this stage. And unless there are any further questions, I will rest.
Any further questions, Judge Cook?
Judge Lawrence? No.
All right, thank you for your argument, counsel. Case will be submitted.